Welcome to College Land, the podcast featuring untold stories about higher education. I'm Nan Enstad in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Lisa Levenstein in Greensboro, North Carolina. We're here to explore life inside our nation's colleges and universities and to track some of the major changes that are happening.
We do this by talking to the people who work there.
Today on our show, we'll share an interview with Deb Fuller about the role of higher education in COVID vaccine research.
And we'll end with our report card, where we will be giving grades to some campus innovations to track and control student movement since the pandemic started. But first, we want to alert you to a new happening in College Land. The American Federation of Teachers and the American Association of University Professors have just launched a joint campaign called A New Deal for Higher Education. And this campaign calls for a massive federal reinvestment in higher ed. Full disclosure, Lisa and I have both signed on to this campaign.
Yeah, and full disclosure, we're really pretty excited about it. And that's because the New Deal for Higher Education recognizes that we need not only a massive federal investment in colleges and universities, but that that investment should be targeted at things like reducing student debt, lowering tuition, prioritizing the core mission of research and teaching, and making sure that all university jobs pay living wages. And the campaign really envisions colleges and universities playing a vital role in rebuilding our post-COVID world as engines of opportunity and upward mobility, reliable employers, and drivers of innovation and cultural production.
And the New Deal for Higher Education seems significant to us because it's not just individuals writing op-eds, it's really big national organizations that are coming together to commit themselves to a campaign that's going to work in Washington and around the country to bring attention to this issue and to call for a national political conversation about higher education, what we want it to be, and how it's related to our collective public life.
And the timing on this is just so crucial because we're at a crisis point that has only been made worse by COVID. So listeners, we're going to keep our ear to the ground on this campaign and we'll let you know what we hear.
If you have questions or thoughts about the New Deal for Higher Education or anything to do with higher education, we want to hear from you. Our email is collegelandpod@gmail.com and you can reach us on Facebook and Twitter at collegelandpod. Now on to our show.
In the past year, as we've waited anxiously for a COVID vaccine, we've heard a lot about the importance of U.S. pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and Moderna. But, you know, we've learned a lot less about the role of university labs in doing the vital research that was needed to develop the vaccines. And I thought about this discrepancy as I followed the recent buzz about the AstraZeneca vaccine. Turns out that vaccine was actually a joint effort by AstraZeneca and Oxford University, but somehow Oxford's name is rarely attached to it. So at College Land, we wanted to learn more about the role of higher ed in vaccine development. And we found Deb Fuller, a vaccinologist and professor of microbiology at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Deb had been working on DNA vaccines long before COVID hit, and her lab had just started working on RNA vaccines in 2019. Her lab has continued research through the pandemic. And she told us that every single one of today's leading vaccines got their start in universities. Let's listen. Deb Fuller, welcome to College Land. You're a professor of microbiology and a vaccinologist at the University of Washington. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what it means to be a vaccinologist? How did you get interested in doing work in this field?
Right. So a vaccinologist is somebody who really studies vaccines, how they work, and also designs and develops new vaccines. Vaccinology is a very interdisciplinary field. It involves immunology, virology, pathogenesis, molecular biology, biochemistry. So you have to kind of be a jack of all trades in a way to be able to do this kind of work.
So how did you get into the field? I mean, what led you to this interdisciplinary exploration?
Oh, wow. That's a loaded question, because I always tell people that my career track is very unusual. And I summarize it in this way, in that I had my career first, then I did sort of a postdoctoral thing, and then I got my PhD last. So I kind of did everything reverse, but let me just kind of elaborate a little bit on that. I graduated from Hope College in Holland, Michigan. I grew up in Michigan and got my bachelor's degree in biology there. And then I went to the University of Wisconsin to do my PhD. But after about a year there, I realized it was in environmental toxicology, and I really wasn't connecting with that. And so I got a job at a biotech company in Middleton, Wisconsin there. It was a plant biotechnology company where I studied development of transgenic crops and started to work on this novel technology for delivering transgenes into crops. And myself, along with a number of colleagues there, began to think about this gene transfer. And that's where we got this sort of idea that maybe we could use this technology for delivering genes into mammalian cells, with the idea of gene therapy. And so we started working on that. And I ended up with this pesky problem that every time I delivered a foreign gene into an animal with this technology, I would get an immune response against. And you don't want immune responses against when you're doing gene therapy. But then another person was recruited to the biotech company, and he came from a vaccines company. And he's a person who really got me into vaccines, because he looked at my data and he got really excited, because you do want immune responses with a vaccine. And so the lights went on in his head as well as my head at the same time, realizing that, hey, this gene transfer could actually be a new vaccine technology. And that was in the late 80s, early 1990s. And it was really the birth of nucleic acid vaccines, which includes both DNA as well as RNA vaccines, which now everybody's more familiar with COVID-19. So that's how I got into it. And of course, I always tell my graduate students, when you come up with a great idea, rest assured there's about 10 other people thinking the same thing at the same time, because the field is ripe for that particular idea at the time. So sure enough, I went to a conference to present our nucleic acid vaccine concept. We were generating immune responses in animals just by putting genetic material into the cells of an animal, and that animal is generating the proteins, the vaccine proteins, and generating immune response. So it was an entirely new concept. Nobody had ever heard of it before. We didn't think so at the time. Got to the conference, and sure enough, there was 10 other people who had thought of the same thing and were presenting something along the same lines. But anyway, it was a Cold Spring Harbor conference in 1991, and that's when DNA and RNA vaccines were born. And I was really kind of at the start of that. So being at the start of an entirely new vaccine platform and technology is definitely the thing that got me just really passionate about vaccines, and then emerging in a career of vaccinology. I ended up working for that biotech company for another 10 years. At that time, though, I had, I had quit graduate school. I had only a bachelor's degree. I was eventually promoted to a PhD level position without having a PhD. And I was working with labs all over the world, learning about their infectious diseases. I call that my sort of postdoctoral period. And then all of a sudden, I had an opportunity in one of my collaborations with a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin to do a study with him in HIV vaccines. And eventually one thing led to another, and he suggested I get my PhD with him. And so I was able to get my PhD at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, concurrent with working full-time at the biotech company down the road. And so that's kind of why everything kind of was backward for me.
You did end up in academia, although it was a winding route, and you now run a lab at the University of Washington. So could you break this down for our listeners a little bit? What does it mean to run a lab at a big research university?
Yeah, so that's a great question. When I first got into academia, when I first got hired for my first academic appointment, was actually at the University of Pittsburgh. I was actually terrified because I was coming from a biotech environment where basically the funding was provided through investments, through various sorts of more commercial sort of quality type things. I wrote grants, but I didn't have to write grants to be able to support my lab. And here I was driving in the car, University of Pittsburgh. And I realized that from now on going forward, my entire career is going to be dependent on my own capabilities of being able to bring in funding, support my own research, not just my research, but there were going to be graduate students and postdocs and staff whose careers and livelihoods were all going to be dependent on me. So when you're running a lab in a university, it's almost as if you're kind of this independent little entity, like your own mini company in a way, but you're the person who has to bring in the revenue. You have to sell the product. In other words, you have to convince people to give you the resources. And then that has to be tied closely with a principle, a whole philosophy that you are training the next generation of scientists. And that's just, it feels like such an awesome responsibility, because when I was in biotech, I was pretty much responsible for my own research and myself. When I transitioned to academia, it was a broader responsibility for my overall research program, to ensuring that it's well-funded and supported. At the same time, this dependence of a lot of these mentees and staff who come into my lab and with all their passion and excitement to work with me. And yet, you know, it's really on me. It felt like it was mostly on me to actually ensure the success of their careers. Just the whole environment of learning and postdocs and graduate students and the people coming in and moving on to their different sort of careers is just such a dynamic and exciting environment in that regard. So I've been in academia now since 2004. So that's going on 16 years, but I spent 17 years in biotech. Because of my long history working in biotech, I have an academic lab, but I collaborate with a lot of biotech companies to help support, you know, evaluating their products and figure out how they're working and the like. And I actually co-founded my own biotech company as well. So I'm sort of one of these people with one leg in both camps there.
Take us back to the early days of the pandemic. You work in Seattle, one of the first places the pandemic reached in the U.S., I think. When did you turn your attention to a coronavirus vaccine, and how has your research been involved in this?
So our attention turned immediately to the pandemic the minute it emerged. So as I mentioned, years ago, when we first started working on nucleic acid vaccines, we saw their potential for pandemic response immediately. And I had already been working for many years on building the platform technology with the idea that one of these days we need to be ready to respond to an emerging pandemic. So I was actually working and had, still do have funding to develop a flu vaccine, actually the next generation flu vaccine, because we'd always figured that influenza could be a potential future pandemic. So we were building out what we call our platform technologies based on influenza. And so when this pandemic broke out, we were like, well, here it is. This is what we've been preparing for all of our career. And so let's get to work. So I had one of the cool things that I had a postdoc just join my lab in December. His name was Jesse Erasmus. And I've been working on DNA vaccines, and he came in with more of an RNA vaccine perspective. And so he joined my lab in December. And when we started to see this thing really emerge as a pandemic towards the end of December of 2019, he calls me up and he says, well, couldn't we just make a vaccine? And I was like, well, yeah, let's go ahead and start making this vaccine. So he got in the lab right away and designed our first COVID-19 vaccine. And that particular vaccine is a little bit different. We thought of it a little bit differently than, say, Pfizer and Moderna. We were thinking in terms of this vaccine would be more of a second generation vaccine, one that would be very cost effective, able to distribute more at warmer temperatures, able to work very effectively at very low doses. So this particular vaccine has gotten far along. We did our preclinical studies, and there's a biotech company, not one that I co-founded, but a different biotech company in Seattle that has taken up that vaccine and is about ready to start phase 1 human clinical trials, which will likely be performed in India.
You know, I'm really interested in thinking a little bit further about the role of people like you, but really higher education more broadly in what's happening right now and has happened leading up to this, because we've learned so much about pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and Moderna, AstraZeneca, right, producing these vaccines. And we've learned a lot about the government's role and coordinating distribution. But in this talk about vaccines, we haven't heard much about universities. Now, just the little we've spoken already, I can hear that people in universities have been working on this for a long time. I mean, can you talk a little bit more broadly about how higher education has been involved in this effort right now, maybe in ways that we don't hear about as much, but are also really important?
Well, I think it's important to note that all of the vaccines that are being licensed right now, all of those particular technologies, they got their start in academia. So for example, Moderna's vaccine actually got a start in the University of Pennsylvania. And so what happens a lot of times is some of the basic foundational work for vaccine technologies or a lot of different sort of technologies and drugs that we have today, they get their start in academia. And then what happens is that often that academic investigator, their technology will get to a certain point where, see, I'm not capable of bringing my ideas all the way to phase three clinical trials and commercialization. At some point, if you come up with an idea in academia, you're probably going to have to link up with some private sector that has going to be able to raise the money, because it all comes back to money, to be able to advance your product forward into and to, you know, through clinical trials and eventually commercialization. So if you look at pretty much I could trace every one of the lead COVID-19 vaccines that are out there right now, including the ones that have already been licensed for use, back to an academic lab. And so you'll see often, if you're more of a translational researcher like me, where you are working lab on some of the basic discoveries, that you either, number one, collaborate with, I say, a biotech company or a pharmaceutical company when your idea gets advanced, or you might start up your own biotech company and see that go forward in terms of that biotech being able to raise the funding to move it to the next level. So there's a very close tie and interactions between academic labs and the private sector to fill that sort of gap between how do you take something from discovery in the dish all the way to the patient. There's quite a complex relationships in there, but they're out there. And I think it's been really important and foundational to the discovery of new medicines. And we can see that definitely in the COVID-19 vaccines.
Is there also an argument to be made for the fact that some of the research that people do might never make it to, you know, become money makers, right? That we don't, what struck me in reading a lot about what's happened with the coronavirus is it seems like there were all kinds of people, many in higher education, doing important work on vaccines, but also on topics like airborne disease transmission, right? And this wasn't sexy or wasn't necessarily thought of as, you know, highly fundable, or, but they were doing this work for years and years. And then all of a sudden it became really vital, right? In helping us to navigate the pandemic. Before the pandemic, you know, they were doing the work, but they weren't receiving a lot of public attention. So it kind of strikes me as an argument for promoting the basic scientific research of all kinds, not just what seems most economically profitable or socially valuable at a particular moment, but that what academia is about in some ways and higher education is about the search of knowledge about of all kinds of things that we don't know necessarily what's going to be valuable at a particular moment. And so do you think that universities do or can play this kind of role in supporting a broad-based research agenda that might not seem immediately profitable?
Yeah, I actually think that's their primary role. And I would say that the majority of the research that's done in academia is of this kind, is of the basic research that forms the foundations for what, say, somebody like me, who's more of a translational researcher, will use that information to then develop, you know, products or ideas for vaccines in this case. So one of the things I love about being in academia is I'm close to these colleagues who, that's what they look at. They look at basic questions. So for example, with vaccines, some of the basic questions that I had to build my particular research on were what kinds of immune responses control SARS-CoV-2? That's just a basic question, but absolutely essential to be able to design a vaccine. In many respects, we got lucky with SARS-CoV-2 in the sense that when it was an outbreak, we had so much foundational basic work already done based on earlier coronavirus outbreaks like SARS, the first SARS-CoV in 2000. By the time SARS-CoV-2 emerged, there were years and years of study and basic academic research understanding, okay, how does this virus cause pathology? What kinds of immune responses are important to control the infection? Oh, that spike protein. See, we could have spent years and years trying to figure that out if this was an entirely new virus, but because we had, you know, 20 some years of research already in coronaviruses, we were able to leverage all that basic science and very, very quickly develop this vaccine. Had this been an entirely new virus nobody had ever seen, we would not be here right now with these vaccines because there would be lots and lots of basic research that would be needed in understanding how the virus causes the pathogenesis, how it transmits, what kinds of immune responses are important, what antigens do we need to target with the vaccine, how are we going to design a vaccine that's able to present those antigens and induce those kinds of immune responses. All that foundational work had already been done. And that's why we were so quick in being able to turn out COVID-19 vaccines.
I'm so struck by that story that you told about the discovery that you had made about DNA and RNA, and then it turned out that 10 other people were kind of working on it and had also been coming to similar conclusions. In what way is science and this kind of research a really something that is done in partnership with other people in which you are, I mean, so on the one hand, it seems like there's this race for profit, there's race for funding, but on the other hand, it seems like right now scientists across the globe are working on the coronavirus, on the pandemic. And how do you communicate with other labs and support other people? To what degree is this a collaborative process? To what degree is it a competitive one?
Right. So that, you know, science has always been building on the shoulders of other scientists before us. And as I described in terms of us building on the shoulders of the scientists who studied the first SARS epidemic that occurred in early 2000. But with SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, something else emerged that is just, I think will change us forever. The change was really releasing your information, your data in real time. Prior to COVID-19, that's not how science was done. We would basically work kind of in our own labs. We would certainly collaborate with other investigators. For example, I'm being more of a vaccinologist. I always collaborate with an immunologist and a virologist, and we work closely together. But we were kind of like our own sort of pods in a way. And then we would publish our data, and then people would use our published data to build on for their own research. What happened with COVID-19, because of the sense of urgency, and of course, in scientists' mind, the passion we have for really wanting to make a difference, and particularly in human health when you're working in areas that I'm working on, is just the need to get out that information in real time. And so you saw scientists putting out pre-publication work, stuff that normally we wouldn't do because we'd be afraid, well, if I put that out there, somebody's going to take my ideas and then, you know, run with it. We didn't care about that anymore. We were just all throwing all of our information out there because we recognized the importance it would have that maybe what I discovered or the information that I have could help somebody else accelerate something they were working on. And so this has just been really revolutionized the information and how we actually share data. We were having real-time webinars presenting our data immediately after completing it. We were putting our papers prior to peer review online for people to see. And we were talking about it quite openly and sharing across a table, not just ideas and results, but even just the raw data and say, hey, can I look at that? Because I think there might be something here that can help me. So I think particularly for vaccinology, I always say, I think we'll always look back on COVID-19 as a pre-COVID days and the post-COVID days, because there really was a change in how we actually did science post-COVID.
Sounds like it's been incredibly fast moving. In fact, I think in October it was, you told a reporter that you'd never worked so fast or so hard in your life. And I can see, you know, with this global sharing, that that's part of what that did, is really sped things up. And I think you said that it felt like everything was moving super fast, but also like one long 9 month day. So can you tell us a little bit about what it's been like to work in this kind of environment? I mean, how are you still standing?
Yeah, it has been absolutely crazy. So when COVID struck, we were already a very busy lab. We had projects left and right. I work on influenza, I work on HIV. We were working on Zika. We had multiple different projects. And all of a sudden COVID-19 comes. And we, for a while, actually, that was the only thing we could work on because of the shutdown. The only labs that could stay open were the labs that were actually working on COVID-19. For a while, there was even initially question whether that should happen. I said, does that even make sense? We have a pandemic and the very labs that could actually discover something to help that pandemic, don't you think we ought to keep running? So unfortunately, the university immediately agreed with that idea. And so we kept running even as we watched all of our colleagues' labs shut down. It was like a ghost lab for a while. We were the only ones on the floor, but working furiously night and day. And then that's why I say it feels like one 9 month long day, because it just has just been constantly going on. And yet, you know, it's gone fast too, because I've never seen research in my lab go as fast as it is.
You did say that you hoped that the coronavirus would serve as a wake-up call that would help us to become better prepared for the next pandemic. I think your point there was that there's always going to be another pandemic. It's really not a question of whether, but when. And so what does that mean for researchers like you, people who are working in universities, when you look towards the future? What do you think your role is or should be? And really, how can the rest of us support you?
Yeah, I think that this is a wake-up call. We have been speaking about this for years. As I mentioned, we were already working on platform technologies. We were already plugging in influenza, thinking that might be, and it might still potentially be a future pandemic. So I think for us, it's just hoping that we sustain that, because, you know, people have short-term memories. So once we've got herd immunity, everybody gets back to their lives as normal. My fear is that we go back to forgetting. Believe it or not, we could forget this time or see it as a distant memory and turn our attention to other hot items at the time. But I think we always have to be prepared. And we have now, because of COVID-19, we have so many amazing tools that we could quickly leverage for any future pandemics. We now have RNA vaccines and these adenovirus-based viral vector vaccines that are coming out, and lots of different technologies and infrastructure that has been built up around accelerating development of products, both vaccines as well as therapeutics for COVID-19, but also those other studies you talked about and understanding how viruses are transmitted, public response, and all those sorts of things. If we can keep all that going, then we are going to be so prepared for the next pandemic. The goal for us is never to see another pandemic again. The goal is to actually identify a potential outbreak and recognize it as a potential future pandemic and be in a position to shut it down before it actually becomes global like this again. So that would be the holy grail of things. And so I think with COVID-19, we have developed the tools and the capabilities and the knowledge, but the support going forward is going to require ongoing attentiveness to the recognition that as long as there's animals and people in the world, there's going to be a potential for transmission of viruses from animals to humans, as we saw with this particular virus, and a potential future pandemic. And so we have to be prepared for the next one. And I always tell people this, that pathogens are the one thing, viruses, bacteria, the one thing that have killed more people worldwide throughout history. And on the other hand, vaccines are the one medical intervention that have saved more people than all other medical interventions combined. So you put those two things together, you recognize the importance of us continuing to support the kind of research that would prepare us and make sure that we never see this kind of pandemic again.
Deb Fuller, thank you for your work and thank you for spending time with College Land.
My pleasure.
So So, Lisa, I learned a lot from this interview about how science works, and I just want to pick up on how you introduced the interview, that we hear in the media about these corporate brands, but not about the academic work on vaccines in universities. And I realized listening to Deb that I had not really understood the relationship between basic science that looks into viruses or proteins or genes, that's not directly about creating a product, and Deb's kind of translational research that takes that basic science and creates something, creates a product. And I also hadn't understood the relationship to biotech companies that have cash and capacity to take a vaccine to a major clinical trial, so that then you start to hear these corporate names and these corporate brands, right? And I guess I can understand why the media doesn't spell all this out when referring to a vaccine. Like, it's pretty complicated. And, you know, it took Deb a while to explain how it works. It's so much easier to just say Moderna. But it makes it seem like corporations are doing this work alone.
Yeah, this really is a question about how ideas take shape and turn into important innovations. And Deb talked about what a collective process that is. I really loved what she said about those early days of research on vaccines in the 90s, about that conference where she and her team realized that there were other people doing similarly pathbreaking research. I really liked how she put it, something like, when you think of a good idea, chances are that there are others thinking about the same idea. I was also struck by the fact that COVID has really strengthened the international community of researchers. People are for the first time releasing their data in real time and making it widely available.
Yeah, I think a takeaway for me from this interview was just all of the different partnerships and collaborations that are required to create something like a vaccine. And it's like collaborations between different kinds of scientists, between scientists in different parts of the world, right, working on similar problems, but then also collaborations between universities and companies. I was really struck by how Deb said she thinks there will be a before COVID and after COVID divide in how science is done. And I have so many questions about this because we know that grants will remain competitive. And Deb talked about the pressure involved in getting big grants to maintain a vibrant lab. And, you know, labs are really like small companies. So I'm just curious, will data sharing continue in the comprehensive way it's been since COVID? We'll have to follow up with Deb in a couple of years to ask her, you know, but maybe, you know, maybe the knowledge that we're going to need to be ready for the next pandemic, you know, and I have to say, I got a little bit of a chill when Deb started talking about the next pandemic, but maybe the knowledge we'll need for that will make virology in particular remain really cooperative. It's comforting to know that even while the rest of us are fixated on just getting through this pandemic, that there are people like Deb out there who are already thinking and working on the next one.
Now on to the segment we call Report Card, in which we assign a letter grade to new developments on college campuses. The first item on our report card today is that several universities, including UMass Amherst and UC Berkeley, have instituted pretty draconian restrictions on students' movement. So after a spike in cases at Amherst, the administration required students to self-sequester for 2 weeks. Basically, what that meant was they weren't allowed to leave their residences except to get meals, undergo their twice weekly COVID testing, attend any medical appointments they had, or perform whatever the university determined to be essential jobs. Students were prohibited from leaving their residence halls to go for a walk or to exercise outdoors. They really were just instructed to stay put. What's troubling about these restrictions is that it seems pretty clear that the spike in cases can be traced to parties that happened on their first week back to campus, not to things like jogging or walking outside.
Right. So the campus clamped down even on outdoor activities that we know are safer, especially when maintaining social distance and wearing masks. And that kind of overreaction can be dangerous. Campus public health messaging and policies really need to minimize infection while also maximizing students' resilience and well-being. We all are struggling right now, and students especially are really struggling and they need some outlets. The problem with a really basic punitive attitude towards students is that if campuses turn into the fun police, everyone will lose.
So we're going to give these unnecessary restrictions on walking and outdoor exercise a D.
Our other item for report card stays on this theme of controlling students during the pandemic and looks at new technologies that track students' bio data and that police cheating potential on online exams. So first, bio data. Some of these technologies are really important and useful. You know, at my school, anyone on campus has to be tested regularly and present a badge on their phone that proves their recent negative test before being admitted to any building. Now, this seems like a reasonable but burdensome requirement. But others are considerably more intrusive. So Oakland University in Michigan released what is called a bio button, a medical monitoring device that sticks to students' skin and measures temperature, and also would be used in contact tracing to let students know if they had been within 15 feet of someone who had tested positive. So the way it works is the bio button transmits data through Bluetooth to an app on students' phones and then into the cloud and can be, you know, sort of toggled with their COVID status. Students raised an uproar, and so the administration backed off on making the bio button mandatory to making it highly recommended.
Students are also protesting the new wave of exam proctoring software. And the Chronicle of Higher Ed is reporting that more than 75% of higher educational institutions either use or are considering using this kind of software. This software is really intrusive. It kind of embeds itself into students' computers, and then it can use their cameras to visually scan both the students themselves, but also their bedrooms or wherever they are located. It can lock their computer browsers and monitor their head and eye movements while they're taking exams. The idea is to make sure they're, you know, looking at the page instead of using notes or looking up information elsewhere.
Yeah, at UW, they just signed a contract with one of these companies, and the product is called Honor Lock, which is such an oxymoron. And there's been a lot of student complaint, and a lot of professors, like me, refuse to use it.
Yeah, I think it's really great that students are protesting these new measures, but I'm pretty worried that the next generation of students, the high schoolers who are now being taught online under COVID and whose teachers are finding various ways to monitor their taking of exams and tests and quizzes, that they're going to arrive on our campuses thinking this is pretty much normal behavior.
Yeah, I think it's really a question about where these kinds of technologies are going, and we do get sort of inured to them. Sarah Igo is a professor of history at Vanderbilt who studies information technologies, and she said in the Chronicle of Higher Education that there's a tendency with tracing technologies for them to linger after their initial purpose fades. She really recommends that we have to pay as much attention to how we kick them off as put them on. So we'll be watching this after COVID too to see how universities respond and use technologies to police and survey their students. We're giving these new tracing and surveillance technologies a C-. There's no great inflation here in college land.
And that's it for today from College Land. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts.
If you have ideas for us, please send us a message at collegelandpod@gmail.com or on Facebook or Twitter at collegelandpod.
Thanks to our producer, the wonderful Rochelle Wilson, and to Wisconsin Humanities for their support.
Thanks for visiting College Land.